यथार्थ्यमर्जुनस्यादौ कुर्वन्येतां तं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्ण, वेलकम टू आवर भगवद्गीता क्लास। सो टुडे विल कंटिन्यू विथ द डिस्कशन ऑफ द थर्ड चैप्टर। वी डिस्कस टू 3.9। वी कंप्लीट द फर्स्ट सेक्शन। द फर्स्ट सेक्शन वॉज अबाउट फॉर अर्जुना कर्मयोग इज प्रेफरेबल टू ज्ञान योग। सो लेट्स लुक एट द चैप्टर ओवर यू बिफोर वी मूव फॉरवर्ड। सो दिस इज द सेक्शन ओवर यू डिस्कसिंग। सो कलयुग KY can be Kaliyuga, but here it is, KY is Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is better for you as you are not qualified for Gyan Yoga. Of course, Arjuna is a pure devotee, and as a pure devotee, he is more than qualified for Gyan Yoga. But in this context, where the Krishna is giving instruction at various progressive levels, so at the level at which he is talking, he says that for one who is not qualified, then Gyan Yoga, practicing Gyan Yoga can create disruption in society, can make one hypocritical, and can make one's own livelihood also difficult. The three reasons we discussed. So now, therefore, you should not practice Karma Yoga. Now we will discuss the second section today. You should not practice Gyan Yoga. That is the first section. You should practice Karma Yoga. So you remember we discussed the spiral. Spiral was, okay, so it was like, don't practice, actually, it starts practice Karma Yoga, better for you, better than Gyan Yoga is Karma Yoga. And somebody says, okay, I'm not qualified for Karma Yoga also. Then what should I do? Then practice Karma Kanda. And practicing Karma Kanda also, you will eventually become elevated. And then if you think that you are overqualified, more than qualified for Karma Yoga, qualified for Gyan Yoga, still practice Karma Yoga to set an example for others. So here we'll discuss the situation when if somebody is not qualified for Karma Yoga, then what should one do? One should practice Karma Kanda. So here Krishna describes about Karma Kanda. So let us look at these verses. Sahayagyah praja srishtva purovacha prajapati anena prasavishyadvam eshostvaishtakamadhuk. So sahayagyah vityagya praja srishtva. So praja is people, living beings, all living beings, srishtva, created. Pura vacha, so pura in the ancient time, vacha said, prajapatihi, so prajapati, that is the lord of all creatures. So different acharyas refer to this lord of all creatures as either Vishnu or Brahma. Prabhupada refers to it as Brahma, as Lord Vishnu over here. And actually, the way Prabhupada describes this, Prabhupada says, doesn't explicitly mention who it is. The Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu. So Prabhupada is not saying Lord of all creatures sent sacrifices for himself. So we could very well say that this is referring to the Brahmaji. So Brahmaji sent forth generations of men and demigods, and he also gave sacrifices, blessed them by saying. But then Prabhupada also says that his whole purport focuses on Vishnu. He doesn't mention Brahmaji anywhere. So in a sense, we could take, Prabhupada gives in such a way that both points can be accepted. So either it is Lord Vishnu who created sacrifices, and he created demigods and human beings, and also created a system of sacrifice, or as a representative of Lord Vishnu, Brahmaji did it. In essence, the consequence is the same. So Prajapati, what did Prajapati say? Anena prasavishyadvam. So by this, become prosperous, be more and more prosperous. Eshavo stva ishta kamadhuk. This, let this be your kamadhuk. So ishta kamadhuk. Kama means desires. Here, kama does not have a negative connotation. Kamadhuk, kama means basically whatever are your requirements, whatever are your needs, whatever are your necessities in life. Kamadhuk. And it is, let this be the provider of your ishtakamadhu, whatever you desire, let it provide it. So what is this referring to actually? Krishna is telling that the system of yajna is there right from the beginning of creation. So when creation is made, just like when parents beget a child, they arrange for taking care of the child. So similarly, when the Lord creates all living beings, he makes arrangements to care for them. What is that arrangement? That arrangement is the system of yajna. So yajna, it is said, is esha vastva ishtva kamadhuk. Let this be a fulfiller of your desires. So there is, in these verses, Krishna talks about a system of cosmic cooperation between the devatas, the supreme lord, and human beings. So we'll discuss this cosmic cooperation system a little later. Here let's focus on the point that when the Lord creates, he doesn't send the living entities into a wilderness. We see this principle of how the Lord arranges in nature, through nature. And when a child is born, when the mother gives birth to an infant, at that time, that same Lord who sends through the mother's womb a child into this world also arranges through the mother's breast to provide for milk for the child. Similarly, we see that there are so many different species in nature and they have their own kinds of food. Not all living beings can eat everything. But these different living beings, under normal conditions, get their food, whatever it is. So, how do they get that? That is arranged by the Supreme Lord. So, in general, if we look at the universe, as we discussed in Om Purnam Adah Purnam, the first classes in our Bhakti Yasri course, this universe is perfect and complete. So, the Lord has arranged to care for the needs of living beings. Now, the lower living beings, lower means those who do not have spiritual faculty developed, the non-human living beings, they do not have to act in any karmically responsible way. They largely act according to their instincts for the sake of eating, sleeping, mating and defending. In human life, we have the advanced spiritual consciousness. And therefore, because we have that freedom to choose, we also need to eat, sleep, mate and defend. But we have the capacity to regulate that. And when we regulate that, by regulating our eating, sleeping, mating, defending, we can choose to redirect our desires towards spiritual reality, towards ultimately Krishna. So, for human beings also, Krishna provides for the necessities. But along with that, human beings also have the responsibility to discharge their duty as human beings. So that duty is material, of course, taking care of our family members and taking care, serving our relationships at a horizontal level. But along with that, there is also a vertical relationship. We have to serve the Supreme Lord, and that system for serving the Supreme Lord is through the arrangement of the universal government. So, through this system, we move forwards, upwards, and serve the Lord. So, anena prasavishyadham, by this system, Krishna says that your desires will be fulfilled. So, when we do yajna, our desires are fulfilled. So, let us look at how this happens. But in this purport, Srila Prabhupada focuses primarily on the purpose of creation and how Lord Vishnu is the ultimate goal of creation. So, the purpose of creation. So the material creation by the Lord of creatures, Prabhupada, so here he seems to say it's Brahmaji, here he says it's Vishnu, Lord of creatures, Vishnu, is a chance offered to the conditioned souls to come back home, back to body. That is the ultimate purpose of creation. And the at a spiritual level, the goal of life is to know Lord Vishnu, Lord Krishna, Prabhupada quotes Vedaishya Sarvair, and we have to return back to him. And then Prabhupada quotes this beautiful verse from the prayers of Shukadeva Goswami, Shriya Patir Yajna Pati Praja Patir Dhyam Patir Loka Patir Dhara Pati Patir Gatish Chanda Krishni Satvatam Prasidatam Me Bhagavan Satam Pati. So, the relationship of this verse with the current Bhagavata verse and discussion is the second glorifying epithet for the Lord, Yajna Pati. So, here we are talking about Yajna, and Prabhupada quote this verse to say how the Lord is the Pati. Pati means master, husband or Lord. So, he is the Shriya Pati. He is the Lord of the Goddess of Fortune, who is beautiful. Yajna Pati, the Lord of Yajna, Prajapati. The word Prajapati is also used in this verse. And the word Prajapati is used by Shukadeva Goswami also. And Prajapati is the master of all living beings. Hyampati, he's a lot of intelligence. Lokapati, he's the abode of all the planets. Dharapati, he's the lord of all the lokas, and he's the lord of the earth also. Dharapati. Then, Patir Gatis Chandhaka Vrishni Sattvatam. And that lord has manifested so as the master of the Andhak Vrishni Sattvatam. These are all various dynasties in which Lord Vishnu had appeared, in which Lord Krishna had appeared. Prasidatam me Bhagavan Satam Pati. Prasidatam means, please be pleased, O dear Lord. May Bhagavan Satam Pati. You are the Pati, the master of the Satam, the devotees, the transcendentalist. So, here, Prabhupada is quoting this verse to point out that Prajapati refers to Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu is the Pati of everyone. Of course, Vishnu and Krishna are the same. So now, then he says that it is this Pati who is manifested, Prajapati, and he has given the system of Yajna. And Prabhupada quoted, in Kali Yuga, we practice the system of Sankirtan Yajna. This will be something which Prabhupada repeatedly talk in this verse, in this section of the Gita. So he quotes a well-known verse about Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, 11.5.32, the Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna Varanam Tusha Krishnam Sangopangastrapashudam Yajnai Sankirtana Prayai Janti Sumedhashah. So Krishna Varanam Tusha Akrishnam. Krishna Varanam means this Lord is the same category as Krishna. Tusha Akrishnam, but his complexion is not like Krishna, it's different complexion. Sa Anga Upanga Strapashudam. So Anga, his limbs, Upanga, his sublimbs, his astras, all these are what? Parshadam. So he has his associates with whom he comes. And what does he do? Yajnai Sankirtana Prayair. So he teaches Sankirtan Yajna, and the Sumedha Shaha, the intelligent people, Medha is intelligence, Sumedha is those who have good intelligence. Yajanti, they worship him by performing Sankirtan Yajna. So he has come and taught Sankirtan Yajna, and we can do Sankirtan Yajna, and by that we can worship him and we can fulfill the purpose of Yajna. So here, what is the point being talked about again? The point is that through Yajna, our needs get fulfilled. Yajna is the means by which we harmonize with the Supreme Lord. And Yajna is the means by which our material and spiritual needs will get fulfilled. So let us try to understand how this happens. Let's look at a couple of other verses. Then we'll discuss the philosophical point more. So the main point here is to recognize the Prajapati ultimately is the Supreme Lord. So how can it refer to Brahmaji also? It can refer to Brahmaji because Brahmaji is a representative of the Supreme Lord. And he is the secondary creator. Some acharyas refer to him as Brahmaji. But it can, as Prabhupada says, it refers to Vishnu. So this is a difference in detail, but the essential principles remain the same. And then after that,
Devan bhavyatanena te deva bhavayantu vaha parasparam bhavayantah shreya paramavapsyatha. So Devan bhavyatanena.
So anena, the word anena was used in the previous verse also. Anena is referring to this sacrifice. So bhavayata, devatas become satisfied by the practice of this yajna. Te deva, then those devatas, bhavayantu vaha, they will satisfy you. So it's a system of cosmic cooperation. You perform yajna to satisfy the devatas, and when they are pleased, they will please you. And parasparam bhavayanta, in this way satisfy each other. Shreya param avapsitha, and by this, ultimately you will attain the supreme auspiciousness. Shreya param. Prosperity will reign for all, as Prabhupada translates it. So, now, let's try to understand this whole system from a perspective of the current worldview. And today, scientists are almost like the priests of society. You know, they decide, this is acceptable, this is unacceptable. So there are some scientists who say that we can't believe in God. But however, we have to understand that actually there is no conflict essentially between science and religion. Although that is often portrayed. Science and religion. Actually there is an eternal conflict between materialism and spirituality. science is basically a tool. Science is just like we have a map. Now, when I look at a map, depending on what the map is used for, I will see the political features of a country. Okay, this state's boundary ends over here, this state's boundary ends over here. Or if the map is a physical map, then I say, okay, there is this mountain ranges over here, this plateau over here, river over here. So it's a map. Now, a map, in many ways, is actually value neutral. A map doesn't tell what is good or what is bad. So science is basically a map. It's a way of looking at the world. So, unfortunately, science has been hijacked and monopolized by atheists. So there are atheists and there are spiritualists. So of course, not all materialists have to be atheists. Essentially, the battle is between materialism and spirituality. Materialism can be equated with atheism, because that's how materialism ultimately leads to atheism. So there is no higher reality in materialism. Matter is the ultimate reality. Then where is the room for God? So atheists have monopolized and hijacked science for their purposes. So today, it means scientists, people say that actually, if you are scientific, then you can't believe in God. If you're scientific, you can't believe in soul. If you're scientific, you can't believe in many of these things which today's research is talk about, which many of the scriptures talk about. Now, this sort of hijacking, monopolization of science by atheists is entirely unwarranted. Now, sometimes Prabhupada may give strong statements against scientists, but his point is that science should be used to glorify God. So, science is criticism is not per se of scientists, its criticism is per se of atheists. So, now are all scientists atheists? No, not necessarily. Many scientists are in the field of science for the sake of earning a livelihood. They also feel that through science and technology, they can contribute something to society through providing comforts and things like that. And there are some scientists who are outright, aggressively, fanatically atheists. And these people think that religion is the greatest evil in society. They will say that the concept of God is a virus that corrupts the minds of people. And they are on a campaign against God. So these scientists, these kind of atheists, fanatical atheists, right-wing atheists, we can say, they are in a minority. They are there, no doubt, and they are vocal also. They quite aggressively do propaganda to convert people to the religion of atheism. So, apart from these people, in general, science is a tool, like a map. Now, science can be used to look at the world. Now, depending on the pre-existing biases of the people, they will pursue things accordingly. Now, there has been a lot of evidence, for example, for the existence of soul and reincarnation, which has come from various sources. So, if science is used to study that, then science can be used to actually point towards spirituality. So, currently, science focuses on studying materialism and promoting materialism. But science can also be used to understand and promote spiritual principles. So we have past life memories, we have near-death experiences, we have these phenomena of consciousness, and all these actually indicate that the soul is different from the body. And the soul moves from one body to another. So these are things which are not unscientific. These have been talked about in science, and there is good amount of scientific evidence for these things. So the point, we won't go into the scientific evidence here. There are articles which I have written on my website, and again the talks also. There we will there this has been talked about. Here our focus on the point that is this whole conception of demigods. Is it scientifically acceptable? It's one thing to say that there is a Supreme Lord, that there is God. Even the conception of God, many scientists feel that it is not scientific. Not many scientists again, it is many atheists. And people in general are influenced and they think that if I have to believe in God, I have to give up science. No. Science is simply a tool And as a tool, it can only look at material things. So science in and of itself can neither prove nor disprove the existence of God. So when it can neither prove nor disprove the existence of God, then how do we know anything from science? See, there are inferences. When we see design in the universe, from that we can infer that there is the existence of God. The design is so intricate that it cannot have happened by chance. It requires supervision. For example, here Krishna will talk about rains. So when we talk about rains, what is the phenomena? The scientists may be able to explain to us how things happen. But if we look at the details, we may say, how do rains occur? Actually, in the sun evaporates water, clouds are formed, and the clouds move along, and wherever the clouds condense, the rains fall over there. But there is no Indra, a predominating god for rains. There is no Vishnu. It's a simple mechanism. The sun evaporates and then condenses clouds. So now we may say this may be the mechanism. But if you go into the integrities, if scientists try to make one little cloud in the laboratory, this is extremely difficult. You know, we evaporate the water and then try to make it in a cloud, and then in a laboratory in a guided way to move it to some other place and then to get it rain. It's very, very difficult. So in fact, some scientists tried something like artificial rains. So I have written an article on my website, Artificial Rains, Imaginary Gains, Real Pains. So, artificial rains, imaginary gains, and real pains. So in India, they had tried to do some artificial rains. At that time, this was written. So now the point here is that, it's a long article, I won't go into all of it. The important point is when they use the word like artificial rains, you have to understand what they actually do. Just like when they use the word artificial life. Artificial rains, actually it's not that artificial rains are created. It is simply clouds that are there, and the clouds are there in the sky. And actually among all the clouds, there is only some cloud that are rain-bearing cloud, water-bearing clouds. Either the white clouds are not water-bearing. So if there are white clouds in the sky, not much can be done. So when you say artificial rains, all that is done is there are already clouds in the sky, but somehow the clouds are not pouring down the rains. So clouds are not condensing. So what is done is certain chemicals are put in the clouds by which rains come down. So this is actually called cloud seeding. You try to get the clouds to produce rain. So it's not artificial rains in the full sense of the word, because the water is not artificially evaporated and made into clouds. Only pre-existing clouds are condensed so that rains come about. So now even in this, if we look at what is actually done, the entire mechanism is so complex, we can't do it ourselves. Even when artificial rains are to be done, actually speaking, if there is a cloud in the sky and the cloud produces rains, we do some seeding and some rains come. Still actually there is very little control where the rains will fall. If the water just falls in the river, if a particular area is there is drought, and then we seed the clouds, and the rain comes, the rain just falls in the rivers and the river water flows away. If it falls in a lake, that is good, it will be saved. If it just falls on the hard concrete surface, it just goes by, it goes and flows away into the gutters, and again it is lost. So there's very little control precisely where the clouds will rain down. Not only that, actually speaking, the amount of water that is present in the cloud and average clouds, that is not so much as to make this whole operation economically viable. And that's why most countries, even countries like America, have considered this artificial rains to be economically unviable. So the point is that even with our best technology, trying to do this is not easy. And not only is it not easy, it is also not viable. It is not economically viable. It's not really productive. So, but the point is, even with the best of our technology, we can't control where the rains will come. We can't produce the rains if the clouds are not there. We can't control the quantity of the rains that will be there. So there is very little we can't control actually. So how does this whole thing happen? If we look at the phenomena in a more technical way, carefully thinking about how it is happening, it's a miracle of technology how a cloud is produced. We have the water getting evaporated, and then basically there are certain chemicals and the water vapor is formed. Certain chemicals are present in the atmosphere. And those chemicals, along with the water vapor, they mix. And there are some dust particles and other things, and they form a cloud. And what is a cloud, basically? A cloud is like a mobile airborne water tank that is made of aircraft-proof technology. The designers of WTO World Trade Centers, they could not make anything aircraft-proof. The towers, although they were marvels of design, they collapse when aircraft collide with them. But entire airplane can go through a cloud, and there's practically no leakage. You know, what kind of water transport company can make any water tank which is aircraft-proof? So the cloud itself is a miracle of technology. First miracle is that it's practically aircraft-proof. Second miracle is that it is made with such ordinary and readily available raw materials. Generally, in this world, the more sophisticated we want to do something, the more rare and complex and expensive raw materials are required to make that. But in nature, it's using the naturally available raw materials in the atmosphere along with water vapor. This mobile, massive, airborne water tank is formed. And then the PVT balances, pressure, volume, temperature balances are adjusted in such a way that the rains fall at a particular place, the rains don't fall at a particular place. So now we may know a mechanism by which this is happening. But the mechanism in and of itself is not the complete explanation. When we say something happens automatically doesn't mean the absence of a controller. Automatically simply means the absence of the awareness of the controller. For example, if a child is having an automatically run toy, then the child just comes into the room and sees this toy is just moving around, moving left, moving right. How is this toy moving automatically? No, maybe there is some remote which is controlling the toy, and that's how the toy is moving. Or maybe somebody has wound the toy, and that's how the toy is moving. So there is surely some controller somewhere. The only thing is whenever we say something is automatic. For example, when we go near a 5-star building, 5-star hotel. Then, as soon as we come near, the door opens. Hey, this door is opening automatically. What do we mean by automatically? We don't see any controller nearby. But all that it means is there is a program by which the control is done. So there is a controller. Only thing is, we are not aware of that controller. What does that mean? There is some kind of sensor. It senses the approach of a human being. And as soon as a human being comes near that, then the sensor senses, and then it press a certain lever, activate certain motors, and then the door opens. So automatically simply means that we are not aware of the controller. There is a controller, definitely. Similarly, when we look at nature, nature seems to act automatically. But automatically simply so means that we are not aware of the controller. There's a complex mechanism over there. And this mechanism is overseen by the Supreme Lord ultimately through the agency of the Devatas. So, actually speaking, there is a whole system of complex mechanisms. So the scientific explanation and the scriptural explanation, they are not contradictory. They are complementary. Contradictory means they oppose each other. Complementary means they both work together. So, now sometimes in some television programs or some movies, we might see some simplistic representations. So Indra is throwing his vajra, and then rain start coming. This is all unscientific. This is mythology. How can such a thing happen? Actually, there is a whole mechanism. So the point now is that is simply for the sake of depiction. Nowhere in the scripture does it say that what we see in movies is a praman. So the scriptures are also aware that there is a mechanism. But the point of the scriptures is they don't go too much into the material mechanisms. They focus on the persons who are overseeing the mechanism. That means when we want to understand nature, when we want to adjust nature, we can do it in two ways. One is that we try to supplicate. Supplicate means, so there are two ways of trying to change nature is supplication and manipulation. Supplication means, supplicate means to pray, to beseech. So we understand that controlling the various phenomena in nature, there are certain beings. And we pray to those beings. We do yajnas. So for example, when a person wants a bountiful harvest, so they want good yield of crops, so at that time they may do yajna and then they get rain. So what is happening over the supplication? So we supplicate the devatas, ask the devatas, please provide us rains. That's supplicative. And the other way is manipulation. Supplication and manipulation. Manipulation means we don't look at the persons who are controlling the mechanisms of nature. We focus only on the mechanisms of nature. And try to, okay, this is the mechanism by this happening. Let me try to rig this mechanism. Let me try to change this mechanism for my purposes. For example, now, if there is a gang of pirates, a gang of thieves, say, who are staying in some forested area, and they want water supply. Yeah, now, they see, okay, there is this pipeline, and the pipeline goes to this village. And in the pipeline, water comes. So one way is that they can go to the government and they say, no, we have got a community over here. We have got 50 people, 100 people, 500 people, whatever their gang is. And please provide a water supply to us also. So then the government will first ask, what are you doing over there? And then if they are not criminals, if say they were some tribals who are law abiding, then the government will say, okay, you have this community. Okay. They apply, they fill the necessary forms, do the necessary requests and whatever procedures are there, and then a pipeline comes to them also. So this is supplicative. Yes, there is a system. We go to the concerned authorities who are in charge of the system and get the water supply. The other is, okay, what is the system now? Okay, the whole system is that there is a pipeline which goes like this, and through the pipeline water goes. So what we'll do is, we will create a hole in that pipeline, put our own pipe, and surreptitiously we'll bring water to our locale, and that's how we'll have water. So what is happening over here? This is manipulative. So when we look at only the mechanisms without looking at the beings who are controlling those mechanisms, and then we try to intervene and use things for our own purposes, then that is manipulative. So what is happening in artificial rains is that they are taking there's a mechanism. Okay, so clouds are formed and clouds give rains. Then clouds condense and the rains fall. So what we'll do is, somehow the cloud is there in the sky, but the cloud is not giving rains only. So it happens sometimes. There are clouds, for some days the clouds are there in the sky, and there are dark clouds also, but they don't give rains. And there are some cases in some countries where the cloud is in one state, and in the cloud is, because of the natural flow of the wind, it is moving towards another state. And what this state, the first state does is that it does seeding and it gets the rains. And in the second state, oh, that was our cloud, it was meant to come to our state, why did you take it? And in a few cases, there have been court cases. You know, this is on, just as we have intellectual property rights, like there are cloud property rights. This cloud is our property, how did you take it? So it's so absurd. So the idea is, we think that, okay, the cloud is just hanging over there, that means it is there for the taking only. So I can just take it. So this is manipulative. So the essential difference between these two approaches is, one is manipulative, one is supplicative. So interfering with the process of nature, that is manipulative. And understanding the higher beings and harmonizing with them, that is supplicative. So these two approaches, as I said, are not contradictory, they are complementary. Yes, that means if they have water supply, yes, there are certain agencies, there are certain authorities who are in charge of water supply. So if we approach them, they will arrange for water to come to us. On the other hand, we can also say, okay, there is a pipeline over there. Now if I tap the pipeline and if I divert the water, there is also one way I can get water. So that there is a mechanism for the water supply does not mean that there is no authority controlling the water supply. So both are complementary. Now, moving forward, somebody says we don't believe in all these things. But whether we don't believe in things or these things or not, the fact remains that we are enormously dependent on nature. We may say that we human beings, we have got so much power, we have conquered space, we have conquered nature. But we still remain dependent on nature. So here, we can look at some statistics. So here, the extent of humanity's dependence on nature is best illustrated through the medium that is valued most in modern society, that is money. So in the science magazine Nature, issued dated 15 May 1997, researchers from the University of Maryland presented the world with a bill to nature for $16 trillion to $54 trillion US dollars per annum for the natural resources and raw materials that humanity takes from nature. So what all do we take? Food, water, air, lumber, rocks, metals, jewels, oil and so forth. So this is the wage. So $16 trillion to $54 trillion US dollars per annum. It's an astronomical amount. And this doesn't include even the sun ray. So if you consider sun bill, our cosmic bill to the sun is far more staggering. American scientist Dr. Edwin Kessler has calculated if he had to pay 5 cents per kilowatt hour, a little cheap price, for the energy provided by the sun every day over the state of Oklahoma, which covers an area of around 200,000 kilometers square, the cost would be around $60 billion per day. It will be $60 billion. Just think how much will be per month and how much will be per year, and this is just for one state. So the fact remains that that we are dependent on nature, and if we were to pay a bill to nature, we would immediately become bankrupt. So now, can we just imagine that, okay, all this is just automatically provided by nature? As I said, automatically means that there is no material, there is no awareness of the controller. But there is a controller, we are simply not aware of that controller. Now, going forward, is there some empirical way in which we can verify the existence of higher beings? Actually speaking, the important point is not empirical verification. The important point is spiritual transformation. So as devotees, we shouldn't have a simplistic notion of this. So the simplistic notion is that, so the devotees often say, we do kirtans and then the rains come. That is okay, it does happen, but it's not just some playing of kartals and singing up some songs that produces rains. What produces rains is the principle of harmonization with the Supreme Lord. So as devotees, our primary focus, we don't want to do Sankirtan to get rains. Our goal of Sankirtan is to purify our hearts, to develop love for Krishna. And to the extent by sharing Krishna consciousness, people learn to live in harmony with God, then to that extent, the rains will come. Natural necessities will be provided for. But still, there are ways in which this can be understood. So, many researchers have pointed out that actually there is empirical evidence for consciousness affecting nature. So, consciousness controls nature is the working principle of the New Age gardeners who seek communion with their plants and crops as a means for higher yields. A vivid example of New Age gardening is the famous Findhorn Farm community in Scotland, which grows amazing flowers and vegetation in barren sandy soil. So this Findhorn community, and then similarly there are other communities. There are the New Age, is Perlandra in Virginia. So the point is, these days any trendy urban bookshop can supply at least a few Deva gardening manuals, the Deva handbook, how to work with nature's subtle energies, or plant spirit medicine, or garden notes from nature devas. Helpful hints that help you to communicate and learn on the Devic level to heal the earth. So here, the point is that those who try to understand that there are higher principles, higher beings, who actually are in control, and if we try to harmonize with them, then we can live more fruitfully in this world. But this is not some mythological belief. This is a philosophical truth. And that philosophical truth can also be experientially verified if we purify ourselves and share the method of purification with others. So now, what exactly happens when we do yajna? The technicalities are very difficult for us to understand because the principle of devtas and how the devtas are worshipped, that is all subtle. See, we often have a very simplistic understanding of things. We say, where is heaven? Heaven is up. Well, that is true, but what does up mean actually? You know, up is not a simplistic up. Because say, everywhere on the earth say that heaven is up. So Indians say heaven is up, Americans say heaven is up. But the earth is round, so India and America are on opposite sides of the earth. So the up for India and America is two opposite sides. So where is up actually? So that up is not a simplistic geographical up. In the Vedic cosmos, there is a vertical dimension. The vertical dimension points to a karmic y-axis. And on this karmic y-axis, there are different planets which are at different levels. So in the Swargaloka is above. In the fifth canto of Bhagavatam, there is a description of Vedic cosmology. And in that description of Vedic cosmology, there is a mention of multiple levels of the universe. So, these distances which are given and the hierarchy of the planets, that is not simplistic geographical. That is, there is a higher karmic dimension. And on that dimension, so different planets are positioned in different ways, at different levels. So, the Swarga is higher in the sense that higher karmic qualification is required to ascend to Swarga. So, we shouldn't have very simplistic notions about what the Vedic teachings are and what the Vedic worldview is. So, in the Vedic worldview, the essential point is that we are all striving to harmonize ourselves with the cosmic government. And the yajna is the means by which we harmonize. So, we discussed in the previous class about the essence of yajna is the principle of sacrifice. So, just like in a credit card system or banking, we put in money and then we get a credit card. That credit card can be used for many purposes. So, the method of exchange is not, it can be variable depending on the economy. System of economy, the culture and such things. But the principle of exchange is universally understood. So it is Krishna is talking here about the principle of exchange. Devana bhavitanena te deva bhavayantuvaha. We satisfy the devatas and the devatas satisfy us. So we put money into the bank and the bank uses a credit card. So this is the system of exchange. This is the same way the system of yajna, it's exchange. So Prabhupada explains the performance of yajna is like paying the tax to the cosmic government. So when we pay the tax to the cosmic government, then the government gives us results. The government gives us rewards. And what are the rewards? The rewards are in terms of the necessities of life which they provide. So this is a whole profound system. And when we do Sankirtan yajna, in Kali Yuga, the recommended form of yajna is Sankirtan. So when we do Sankirtan, we are harmonizing with the system, universal system of government. So when we do this yajna, what exactly are we doing? Yes, we are chanting, we are dancing, we are singing. But essentially along with that, those are the means by which we are harmonizing with the Supreme Lord. So our goal is that, like I earlier was talking about, say there is a community of thieves, lawbreakers. And there is no water supply coming. Now, if they want water supply, what should they do? If say, there's a community of 100 robbers living in some forest, and there, 2-3 of them start deciding that we want to pay the water tax. We want to become law-abiding citizens. So, will that alone lead to water supply coming over there? It may or it may not. Now, overall, if the whole law, a whole community decides to reform itself, then water supply will be provided by the government. So, similarly, in today's world, if some devotees start chanting Hare Krishna in a place where there are droughts, will rains come? They may or may not. It depends, you know, depends on the karma of the people over there, the mass karma that is there, and various factors are there. On the other hand, so our goal is not just that we don't want to do yajna to counter the law of karma. The law of karma is that actions produce reactions. So if there are the shortage of water, that is because people have done certain bad karma because of which they are having shortage of water. So our goal should be to provide people proper philosophical education and to encourage them to reform themselves. So when they stop doing bad karma, then the nature will start providing its necessities. And in that way, there will be harmonization with nature and the provision of necessities. So our focus is not on doing yajna to provide rains. Our focus is on doing yajna, on chanting and glorifying the Supreme Lord, by which people learn to live in harmony with the cosmic government. And then rains will automatically follow. So this is the system which Krishna talks about. Devan bhavayatanena te deva bhavayantuvah. Let's look at the next verse. So Prabhupada quotes this well-known verse in his purport from the Shrutis, Ahar Shuddhau Sattva Shuddhi, Sattva Shuddhau Dhruva Smritihi, Smriti Lambhe Sarvaganti Vipramokshaha. So he says, what Ahar Shuddhau, when we offer our food in Yajna and then take this, the Ahar becomes Shuddha. When the Ahar becomes Shuddha, then Sattva Shuddhi, our existence becomes pure. Sattva Shuddhau Dhruva Smritihi, then our memory becomes purified, sanctified. Smuti Lambhe, when our memory is sanctified, then Sarva Granthina Vipramokshaha, when we start remembering Krishna, when we start remembering spiritual reality, then we are no longer attached to material things. And then Sarva Granthina, all material attachments, Vipramokshaha, we become liberated from them. Ishtan Bhogan Hivo Deva Dasyante Yagya Bhavitaha Taivdattan Apradayebhyo Yo Bhunte Stena Emasaha. So Ishtan Bhogan, when we give to the devatas, Hivo Deva, devatas are in charge of the various necessities. Ishtan Bhogan, our necessities, desired necessities, Dasyante, they will provide Yagya Bhavitaha, when we satisfy them by Yagya. Taivdattan, Tairdattan means that those things which we are given, apradayaibhyo. So if we do not offer them back to the devatas as naived, yo bhungte stena eva saha. So Krishna says that if we don't participate in the system of cosmic cooperation, then we become thieves. Yo bhungte stena eva saha. Such people are thieves. And just as we discussed, those who take the water supply but do not pay the taxes, they are considered thieves. So like that, if we don't satisfy the devatas, then we become thieves. So now, if we look at the various Vedic sacrifices, sometimes it seems as if the devatas are dependent on yajna performed by us. So for example, 7th canto Hiranyakashipu says, if we stop all the yajnas, then what will happen is, the devatas will starve. And when devatas starve, then they will all become weak and we will kill them in battle. And that's how I will become supreme. So, are the devatas dependent on for their needs on human beings? Actually, Swargaloka and the local devatas are far more opulent, far more sumptuously provided than the earth is. So, you know, if we say that the devatas are dependent for their food on the earth, on us earthly beings, then it's like saying that, say, the wealthiest country in the world, say America, is dependent on a poor country like Somalia. So, that's not proper. Now, if we look at otherwise in the scriptures, you know, when Indra's yajna is stopped by Krishna, you know, Indra is not concerned, oh, my yajna is stopped, I'll starve to death, I'll starve to death, what will I do? No, Indra gets angry because he feels he's dishonored. Similarly, when Lord Shiva is not offered a section of yajna in the 4th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th chapters, this whole pastime comes along. So, there, Parvati, Satish, her anger is not, oh, my husband will starve to death. So, my husband is disrespected. That's the fear. So, the point is, it's an acknowledgement of authority. It is just like when a worshipable guest comes to our place, then we offer that guest maybe a garland. We may do some aarti. Now, it's not that garland and aarti are necessities for that person. It's not that if those are not offered, the person will die. But that is the way we respect that person. So similarly, the performance of yajna, it is not a necessity for the devatas. It is a way in which we respect them. And just as when a very worshipable guest comes to our place, we need to offer respect and worship, because that will purify us. And if we don't do that, then it can be offensive. So same way, if we don't offer the yajna to devatas, then it can become offensive from our side. So therefore, it's not that devatas are like nutritionally dependent on the earth. No, it is a part of the system of cosmic cooperation. And if we don't play our part, then it is a dishonor for them. And ultimately, it is a disrespect for the Supreme Lord, because we are not doing our part in the cosmic government. Now, of course, Krishna told the Vrajavasis to stop doing yajna, not because he wanted to disrupt that system, but he wanted to check Indra's pride. Devatas should take respect on behalf of the Supreme Lord, not that they think that they are the Supreme. So because Indra was temporarily thinking that he is all in all, so Krishna wanted to curb his pride. But Krishna in general doesn't disrupt the system of yajna. In fact, he encourages the system, as we'll see over here. So if we try to enjoy separate from the yajna system, then yo bhunkte ste naiva saha. Such a person is a thief. So now Prabhupada talks about the Pancha Maha Yajna. There are five different kinds of yajna which are performed. And these yajnas are meant to ultimately help people get elevated. So actually, why are the yajnas required? There are different five primary ways in which people can perform inevitably bad karma. When we light a fire, at that time some living beings are killed. When we walk along, some living beings get killed. When we put a pot of water, there may be some living beings that may get killed. So like that, even in our normal day-to-day activities, when we use a mortar and pestle, at that time some living beings get killed. So the specific ways in which living beings can get killed, there are five general ways you're talking about in the Vedic culture. And those can apply as per mutatis mutandis, means making necessary adjustments according to his culture, to our situation. The point is that we all inevitably commit violence. And if we want to avoid the karmic consequences, then we have to do these kind of yajnas. So of course, in Vedic culture, they will do the Panchavagya yajna. So now in Kali Yuga, we do Sankirtan yajna. So now we come to a verse which Prabhupada would quote quite often. Yajna shishta sina santo mucchante sarva kilvishvi vanyute te tvagam papa ye pachanti atma karanat. So yajna shishta. Shishta means remnants. Aashinaha. Aashinaha means to accept or to eat. Santa. Santa are the devotees, the saintly people. Mucchante sarva kilvishai. Mucchante is to become liberated. Kilvishai is contaminations or sins. So by taking the remnants of yajna, the saintly persons become free from all sinful reactions. Bhunjate te tvagham papa. So agham. Agham is sin. Papa are the sinners. So who are the sinners? Ye pachanti atma karanat. Those who pachanti is those who cook food for atma karanat, for their own purposes. So those who try to eat food for their own purposes, the cook and eat food, they consume sin only. So the point is that actually in all cultures there has been some acknowledgement traditionally that we should offer some kind of prayer to a higher being. So Christians may offer grace, they fold their hands and pray. Oh yes, actually we should serve the Supreme Lord. So we thank God for providing us food. So like that, in different religions, there may be different traditions, there may be different ways of acknowledging that the food that we get is by the arrangement of a higher being. It doesn't come just by our own efforts. Our efforts are important, no doubt, but they're not all important. So, yajna, so when we offer food to Krishna, what are we doing? We're acknowledging Krishna. actually I have no capacity to produce food. So you have provided me this food and I'm grateful to you for that. So in that way, when we offer the food to Krishna, yagyashishta ashinaha, when we accept the food that we offer to Krishna, then we acknowledge Krishna's mercy on us. And by that acknowledgement and by the devotional connection that we establish through that acknowledgement, then Krishna frees us from sinful reactions. Yagyashishta ashina santaha. So that's why devotees take food that is offered to Krishna. Now when we talk about prasad, there are multiple standards of prasad. The best standard of prasad is the food is cooked, food is cultivated, the grains are cultivated by devotee farmers. Then the grains are transported by devotee businessmen. The grains are then cooked by devotee cooks. And then the food is served by devotees, and then the food is honored by devotees. So that is the best standard of prasad. If that is not possible, then we have devotees cooking food and devotees honoring food. Of course, among those who honor, there can be non-devotees also. They'll also become purified. So generally, prasad is not just food that is offered to Krishna. Prasad is food that is cooked to be offered to Krishna. So in general, we try to take prasadam that is cooked with the intention of offering to Krishna. In some situations, it's not possible. So at least we should offer the food that we take to Krishna. So when we offer to Krishna that food, then it becomes free from sinful reactions. So vegetarianism is important, but vegetarianism is not all important. Vegetarianism in and of itself doesn't free us from all sinful reactions. And vegetarianism doesn't purify us. It does minimize the sinful reactions that we get. And it also minimizes the huge amount of violence that happens today nowadays through the meat packing industries. So all that can be minimized and avoided, even avoided if people shift to a vegetarian diet. But the important point is that even if the food is vegetarian, actually one is eating sin if one is not offering the food to Krishna. Therefore, it is important that as devotees, we offer the food to Krishna. So Prabhupada adopted different strategies. You know, Peter Barwash was a famous tennis player, and when Prabhupada met him, Prabhupada saw that he was very influential. Prabhupada told him that you elevate global consciousness, and he gives subtle sattvic principles. You know, he talks about vegetarianism, he talks about caring, he talks about responsibility. And he didn't talk about, Prabhupada told him, you promote vegetarianism like that. But then, so those who were in a position where they could commit more, for example, there was that book PQP, Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers. So there Bob Cohen met Srila Prabhupada, and he said, Swamiji, I'm a vegetarian. So Prabhupada told him, monkeys are vegetarians. What is the big deal about it? So for him, from a Western background, being a vegetarian was quite a remarkable achievement, and he was proud of that. So Prabhupada acknowledged that, but at the same time, he said, no, there's nothing great about that. The point is that we have to rise us higher and become conscious of Krishna. So as devotees, the practical way in which we apply this principle of yajna is through taking prasad. So in the Vedic context, in the Karmakandi context, the principle of yajna would apply in a different way. There would be fire sacrifice. And through that, the remnants of the fire sacrifice, whatever they were, they would be taken as prasad. So now, in our situation, we have the deity, and then we offer prayers to the deity, we offer the bhoga, and then we take prasad. So, you remember earlier we discussed about how there is the principle of yajna and there is the form of yajna. The principle is we offer for the Lord's pleasure what we could have used for ourselves. So, when we cook, we primarily cook because it's for the Lord's pleasure, and then we take for ourselves. So, in this way, we can also stay free from sinful reactions. Not only will we stay free from sinful reactions, we'll become purified and elevated by the potency of yajna shishta asina, the remnants of yajna, that is prasad. We'll continue in the next class. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.